And that's the beauty. I mean, for me, that's the great thing about writing a novel, that you are handing something to the reader. I think some novelists labor under that you kind of, you have control of it. You know exactly what it's supposed to mean. No, I think it's much more interesting if you create something that you give to the reader and the reader decides what they're going to do with it, what they're going to make of it. And the book then takes on a different life and goes on being sort of recreated every time somebody reads it.
You're listening to The Gould Standard, Charles Palliser and the Power of Five.
Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine, and welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. And we're here once again, bringing you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If novels, poetry, music, film, visual arts, theater, and multimedia extravaganzas are the ketchup to the French fries of your life, then you have come to the right place, my friends. But first, while you're stopping by under our frantically flickering neon piano sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you just so happen to be listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews, pose your questions, and be part of our community of friends and supporters. While you're at it, be sure to check out our past episodes featuring a cavalcade of luminaries, stars, and fascinating folks, as well as our recent Glenn Gould at 90 special episodes. And to get more resplendent sounds, winning words, and intriguing images, we'd love to have you pay us a visit at our website, glenngould.ca. When you're there, if you are suddenly seized by an irresistible impulse to part with some money, please click the donate button and support the charitable work of the Glenn Gould Foundation. We'd be proud and honored to have you as a supporter. Now, today my guest is the author of one of my all-time favorite novels, a book that I've recommended time and time again to friends, colleagues, and anybody who enjoys the kind of reading experience that plunges you headlong into an alien, yet oddly familiar world. And by the way, that isn't a science fictional world. It's a book that makes you confront questions about how to know what is true, what is real, and how to make sense of life when confronted by deception, incomplete information, and betrayal. I'm referring to The Quincunx, a surprise bestseller when it first appeared in 1989, and our guest is novelist Charles Palliser, the creator of that novel. Charles is the author of 5 works of fiction, a quincunx of novels, one might say, each combining elements of mystery, ambiguity about interpreting what is real and what is deception, perception, or misremembered history. And I'd like to talk about each of those books today. But we'll start with the literal elephant in the room, that enormous first novel, The Quincunx, that took Charles 12 years to write and has rewarded my readings and rereadings ever since it first appeared. The Quincunx is, on one level, an historical novel and has been called an homage to Dickens and Wilkie Collins, but the book is surprisingly modern, an elaborate and meticulous construction in which what seems clear at one moment is turned on its head the next, as different explanations of the central mysteries collide with each other. And in just the same way, the book turns out to be much more than a pastiche of Victorian fiction, with its multiple unreliable narrators and cascade of clues and accounts of past events, blurred by fading memories, missing pages from a secret journal, and much more. The novel is also a spectacularly detailed portrayal of pre-Victorian England, from its gaudy extravagance to its horrendous, degrading poverty. And hopefully that's whet your appetite. If you haven't read the book, of course, now's the time to, wait till the end and then go and click on your local bookseller and order a copy. But in the meantime, Charles, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you very much for asking me. It's a great pleasure, great honor.
Now, your work is so interesting and so singular. You must have had some very interesting early experiences to form your literary tastes. Can you give us a kind of an overview of how you became interested, for one thing, in period fiction, in Victorian novels, and how that basically stayed with you throughout your literary career?
Well, I suppose I often say that I had a Victorian childhood, by which I mean that I was a big influence on me was my grandmother, who, of course, was born in the 1890s. And she was a great reader, as indeed was my mother. Both of them encouraged me to read books, and particularly the classics, Dickens. And it is the case, people find this hard to believe, but by the age of 13, I had read every Dickens novel at least once, and they made a huge impression on me. And I think that it was that experience, as well as other reading experiences, that led me to realize that I was going to have to devote my life to literature, both trying to write it, but also I was sort of realistic enough to realize that you don't just sort of become a novelist overnight. I became a lecturer in English literature, and I did that for nearly 20 years. And it was the perfect situation for me. I was both teaching Victorian literature. I mainly specialized in the Victorian novel, and I was kind of trying to write one. It was quite odd. A lot of the time, I didn't really know whether I was preparing lectures for my students or doing research for my own novel, and that was fine. I mean, I hope everyone benefited. I know I benefited from that.
You are an American by birth, an Englishman by upbringing, but you were a Scots by profession in the sense that you were teaching in Scotland, right?
I was there for 20 years. I mustn't forget the Irish element through my mother. So I'm an Irish and an American citizen, but oddly enough, not a British subject. Don't think I really want to be a subject anyway. It's much better to be a citizen. So I lived in Scotland for about 20 years. And that was interesting because, like a lot of people outside Scotland, and certainly English people, I didn't realize how different it is in so many ways culturally. It has its own literature. It has its own sort of cultural traditions and so on. And so I found it was quite interesting sort of in my mid-20s to suddenly realize that I had to read a whole new literature that I hadn't really got into. And there are, of course, some extraordinary Scottish writers. A huge impact on me was James Hogg, the Confessions of a Justified Sinner, which is an extraordinary book, which I've read several times. And you can hardly believe that it was published in the 1820s. It's almost a modernist novel in so many ways, with an unreliable narrator, lots of different conflicting narratives, and somebody at the center of it who you realize eventually is insane.
Well, I've always felt that even going back to the 18th century, if you want things that really depart from the mainstream of literary taste in the English language, you have to look at the Celts. So, I mean, if you think about Sterne and Tristram Shandy, a book that I still struggle to make sense of and wonder what he was on when he wrote it and how, you know, so many sort of prescient anticipations of other literary techniques that came more than a century later. But in teaching Victorian literature, which you indicated was a large part of your teaching life, I take it that you went well beyond Dickens, that you were into teaching Eliot and Trollope and Thackeray and some of the other lesser-known Victorians, Wilkie Collins.
Wilkie Collins is a huge passion of mine. I don't think I actually managed to get him onto the syllabus, as far as I remember, because he's considered sort of snobbishly sort of not quite a literary writer, which is silly. He's a very fine writer. He's also one of the funniest writers in the 19th century. I've never taken to Trollope. I don't know quite why, because I love English cathedral towns and all the rest of it. I love all the sort of politics of a sort of small community, but somehow Trollope just absolutely has never worked for me. I think I find him quite kind of limited, and there isn't the sort of linguistic exuberance that you'd get in Dickens.
I couldn't agree more. I've tried starting with The Warden, and it just felt flat. And you know, Dickens has often been criticized for being creating caricatures more than characters sometimes. But I've always found that his ability to conjure up scenes, the relish of his descriptions and the intricacy of his plotting and the psychology of his characters is there. It's just not sort of thrust so far forward in your face.
Yes, I think there isn't a sentence of great sort of power or beauty in Trollope, or at least I didn't come across it. But some of Dickens' descriptions are just extraordinary. They have all the resources of poetry. They're deeply evocative and mysterious. I mean, Dickens, of course, is I suppose the one the greatest writer who has the worst faults. Actually, that's the interesting thing, that he's a wonderful writer in spite of the sentimentality and the oversimplification and the plots that sometimes get completely out of control, and that he rescues with the most absurd coincidences. But one forgives him all of that because of the extraordinary things that he does so well.
And every great artist produces some works that are less great, or has moments that are less great, that don't reflect their best, because especially when you look back to a period where artists were not only artists, but also workmen and work women, work folk, who, you know, had a professional life and were expected to, you know, meet deadlines, produce installments on a regular basis, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. You can certainly forgive them for occasionally, you know, relying on their professionalism rather than their inspiration.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the fact that Dickens wrote, I think, all or virtually all of his novels as serials, which meant that he didn't know from one month to the next what was going to be in them, what he was going to write. I mean, being faced with a blank page every month seems to me extraordinary. But then that's part of probably why somehow or other the adrenaline was made to flow. Because a lot of writers worked in that way. Dostoevsky and Balzac, I know, certainly worked in that way. I mean, I can't imagine doing that. I mean, I've once or twice worked to a deadline, and I find it does actually get something flowing, but I wouldn't really want my whole sort of literary career to depend on my ability to do that.
Now, to fully appreciate, well, especially Dickens, because Dickens, of course, has come down to us as not only a great author of sentiment and a great portrayer of scenes and plots, but also as a social reformer. Whether that was explicitly his intention or not, he certainly seems to have had that effect. And I've read that another influence of yours was Mayhew, who basically chronicled the underside of Victorian society in his lifetime. Can you tell a little bit about that? Because I think it really is present in your work, well, in the Quincunx, especially the level of historical detail, of social history that is captured, that really, in a sense, is beyond Dickens.
Yes. I was very lucky. When I was 11, my family rented a house from a retired dentist, and he'd left his library behind. And one of the books was a collection of Mayhew's interviews with the poor. It's called London Labour and the London Poor, in fact. And he went out in about the 1830s, it's thought, and recorded interviews, which he published some years later, with the poorest people earning a living on the streets. And what struck me, even at 11, I think, was the extraordinary sort of clarity and poignancy of their voices coming down through that long period, speaking with absolute sort of honesty and frankness, and often very articulately. And Mayhew used, as I discovered later, a system of shorthand. So they are close to being verbatim. And they're probably the earliest accounts of working class speech that we have in Britain. Because, of course, it was very unusual at that time to take note of what working class people were saying. And I did think, as I was reading them, and I thought, reread them and thought about them down the years, there are all these sort of untold stories of the very poor, because what we mostly get, of course, in Victorian fiction almost exclusively, is the voices and the experience of middle-class people who were, what, 20%, 15% of the population as a whole.
Right.
And so when I set out to write the Quincunx, I mean, one of my main ambitions was to try to kind of give speech back to these people who had vanished almost silently into the mists of history.
I want to get to that in a bit, but it really is remarkable the ability that Mayhew had, because Mayhew was also a very literary person. He was one of the co-founders of Punch and was a novelist, I believe, though not an enormously successful one in his own lifetime. And yet the contribution to social history, and I guess, you know, he could be considered a sort of a proto Henry Higgins, in the sense that he captured the speech of, you know, people from different parts of society and different areas of London. And of course, it's all London. In the Quincunx, you go outside of London. But we'll get into that. The Quincunx, by the way, for those who don't know, if you have ever played with a pair of dice and you've rolled double fives, you are looking at a pair of quincunxes. So basically, that pattern, based on the number five, with four corners and one spot in the center is a quincunx. So now that we've dealt with that, so that no one need ever ask again, but you'll see one on the cover of the book too, just in case you need the reminder. Describe the literary environment in which you began your teaching career, because it seems to me that must have been the efflorescence of postmodernism. You must have been surrounded by structuralists and deconstructionists and, you know, people quoting, you know, Derrida and Le Man and Barthes. Did you feel out of step with this particular academic zeitgeist?
Yeah, that all hit me. It hit British universities in the early 80s. All this post-structuralism suddenly arrived. And in fact, my department was suddenly sort of invaded by a number of post-structuralists. I found it kind of interesting as a sociological phenomenon. I never really understood it, but then I think that, frankly, that was true of most of the people who were practicing it. And I sent it up in betrayals, of course.
Absolutely. Well, I would say with a rapier wit and possibly a scalpel. But it's interesting because, you know, when movements hit the academe, they can be rather territorial and they can basically have a negative impact on the teaching life of those who are not part of the movement. Did you ever find yourself sort of, well, he's teaching in a bygone way about bygone literature, and he's not looking at, you know, what the power dynamics are of the, you know, et cetera, that sort of thing?
There was something of that going on, but I mean, luckily, I think we sort of more traditional teachers of literature were still in a majority. So I think we kind of fought our corner quite well. I always thought about academics who teach English literature in universities, that they are mostly frustrated creative people. A lot of them, of course, you know, wish that they were poets or novelists, and many of them are, of course, as I was, I suppose. But I think a lot of the frustrated creativity goes into other areas. And I think post-structuralism was a liberation for that. A lot of the stuff that I read seemed to me incredibly self-indulgent in a good way, I mean, and a bad way as well, but often very, very kind of imaginative, creative, not really terribly disciplined, not really giving you very many insights into the work, but allowing the writer to kind of write, you know, highly literary and inventive essays. So that in that sense, it was quite, I looked on it fairly benignly, although I did think that it was putting students off actual literature. That was one of my big worries, that increasingly they were not being encouraged to read the existing text. Interestingly, they were being invited to spend more time on kind of quasi-philosophical issues of the kind that Foucault and Derrida and Lacan and so on indulged in.
As an undergrad, I had a passing encounter with some of that, and I basically, you know, found it left me very cold, so I stayed away from it. But it strikes me that it's very hard to love the texts when you take that particular analytical approach, that it's actually can be a barrier to, you know, I mean, one hopes that, you know, the first step on the road to wanting to understand and explore and reveal truths about texts is to actually love them and to feel a passionate engagement with them. And I've often felt that is not present in the postmodernist approach.
No, I agree with that. I think there was always a tendency in my experience in the study of English literature in universities to encourage students to spend far more time on reading up the secondary work to sort of find out what the kind of prevailing critical opinion was, and not to spend nearly enough time on simply getting to understand the text. I mean, I regarded myself, I was actually called a formalist. In fact, some of my colleagues, I think, used that term quite negatively. And that meant that I didn't want to kind of jump off from the text to argue about political or religious or philosophical theories. I actually just wanted them to see how the thing was put together, how it actually worked. I was kind of moving towards teaching creative literature, teaching people to write novels inside a literary department, because creative writing didn't exist at that time in the UK. So that, in that sense, I was certainly at odds with post-structuralist colleagues who, frankly, were not interested in the text, except as a kind of minimal jumping-off point for speculative theory.
Absolutely. And to a certain extent, you know, at least when I encountered this school, it was essentially, you know, there were teachers who held up the text as kind of symptoms of some underlying social malady that needed to be exposed and then hopefully corrected. And rather than saying these are works that are trying to find a kind of truth in their own right and do so with some illumination and possibly some beauty, and also to give us an insight into the minds of people whose worldview and whose world experience was very different than our own.
Absolutely. I wish you'd been a colleague of mine in the 80s. For example, Conrad. I remember discussing Conrad with a colleague who accused Heart of Darkness of, you know, of all the sort of failures. It was colonialist and it was racist and all the rest of it. And for me, it's one of the most astonishingly brilliant insights into the nature of the conquest of one culture by another culture. And to call it racist and colonialist seems to me to be an astonishing misreading. What Conrad's doing there is he's diagnosing a kind of disease of the arrogance of Western of European power, believing that it has a kind of right to go into a country like the Congo. And what he shows is that the Heart of Darkness is actually not in Africa. The Heart of Darkness is actually in Kurtz, the liberal enlightened European who becomes completely, he becomes a kind of savage and a cannibal. So it's an extraordinary analysis of the kind of mindset of imperialism. But my colleague wouldn't see that, and she said, I would ban Conrad. I wouldn't teach Conrad, which seems to me an extraordinary attitude. Because even if you think that Conrad does exemplify colonialism and racism, then surely this is a perfect text in which to discuss those things. If you want an insight into them, Conrad gives you an insight. But in fact, as I've said, I don't think Conrad is remotely doing that. And I said to her, well, if you're going to ban Conrad for being sort of his time, you also have to ban Jane Austen for her attitude to women, which is not that of the early 21st century. It's that of the very early 19th century. And my colleague said, well, I would ban Jane Austen as well. And I realized that there was this belief by some of my colleagues that you can't teach literature that you don't agree with. It's got to be impeccably kind of ideologically pure as we think of that now. And of course, if you leave out a historical context, you're not going to understand the literature of that period. You're going to simply dismiss it by very kind of localized 21st century assumptions, which will change. And in 50 years' time, people will look back at us and accuse us of all sorts of failures of moral insight.
Oh, but no. The people who occupy the departments of social sciences are the pinnacle of human evolution, and nothing greater can ever be achieved. There can be no insights that will explode their wisdom about the world. Surely you know that.
Yes, and that's the thing, that every age thinks that it has now found the truth.
Yes,
but one of the points of studying history and literary history is to see that, to see that people in the 12th century, people in the 18th century thought that they had discovered all the answers. And what that should tell you is that our own answers are provisional and they will eventually be displaced and superseded.
Right, exactly. What's that wonderful line from Barry Lyndon? Thackeray writes, in fact, it's when Kubrick made his film. He used it as the final line of the film. But what is it? All of our characters, great or small, wise or foolish, are all equal now, or something to that effect. And so, I mean, we all essentially, at whatever period in history, assume that we've arrived at the final answer. I hope you asked your colleague what books she wouldn't ban.
I didn't ask her that, really, because I should have, I suppose. I think the her canon would have been very, very limited, and I think it would have been very recent, and I think it would have been left-wing, feminist, anti-racist authors. Nothing wrong with any of that, but that does rather leave out Shakespeare and Chaucer and Dante and Goethe, of course.
Right. I can't see the value in only having a conversation with people who believe with you. That kind of feels like the mindset of certain political movements in history from the last 100 years that I think we've done well to discard. But anyway, I didn't mean us to get quite so far down that particular avenue. I want to actually now talk about the Quincunx, which has given me so many hours of pleasure. The novel, I don't like to synopsize, but I'll do a little bit. It presents the trials and adventures of a young man in early 19th century England, born about the time that Charles Dickens was born, and accidentally with a very similar name, who gradually discovers that his birth places him in the Quincunxian center of a multi-generational battle by five families for the inheritance of one of England's oldest and largest landed estates. And the hero, and sometimes narrator, John, discovers that his idyllic childhood is really a veneer that conceals a myriad of plots to destroy him, because his very life is an obstacle to the various claimants to the estate. And that sort of launches us and John on a journey that really takes us through the deepest recesses of poverty, crime, and treachery in early industrial England. Now, I assume that one doesn't set out to write an 800-page novel meticulously constructed with an obsession for the number five. So how did you get from, you know, the day that you said, I think I'm going to write something, to this enormous, sprawling book, which, by the way, for those who haven't seen it, I think this is the original hardcover edition. It is excellent for weight-bearing exercise. So those of you who like to exercise your minds and your limbs, I'll say again, get a copy.
Well, I you're right. I mean, when I started, I had no idea that it was going to be an enormously long book and that it was going to take me 12 years. What happened was that I just had this idea of a small boy in a garden with his mother and a nurse, which a lot of people have pointed out is the sort of David Copperfield situation. But as with a lot of the situations in Dickens, what I tried to do was to take something that's sort of known and familiar and then just sort of darken it and all sort of look at it from a different angle. Of course, in David Copperfield, Peggotty is wonderful and she's loyal and she's dedicated. But my version of Peggotty is not that at all. She has her own agenda, shall we say.
Yeah, Bissett.
Yes. She precipitates, in a sense, she precipitates the whole sort of series of disasters that befall John and his mother. And I wrote about 50,000 words of that story of how their apparently idyllic life in a remote country village is sort of gradually undermined by interventions from the mother's past coming from London. And when I got done 50,000 words, I stopped because I realized I had no idea where it was going after that. And I then, what I suppose I did was I kind of drew out the threads of that situation and kind of elaborated a whole set of circumstances under which this young woman and her child would have had to flee and hide, which is what she's doing. She's hiding. Why is she hiding? Who's she hiding from? What has happened? Where is the boy's father? And all of this. And I spent, I mean, literally about 3 or 4 years just working out what the sort of narrative was going to be. And ended up with an enormous synopsis of the whole thing. And then I started writing it. I went back and started writing it. So I always say that its length was sheer incompetence on my part. I really didn't know what I was doing. And I became horrified as a pile of manuscript got bigger and bigger. And eventually, in fact, I had to start cutting whole sections of the plot in order to make it remotely publishable. I mean, it comes in at, I think, around 430 or 440,000 words, which is about five times the length of an average novel. So I was taking a huge risk at that point.
And that's very interesting. I've read that the synopsis itself was novel length.
Yes. So it was 80,000 words. Yes, that was about the length of an average novel. And another writer, a friend of mine who followed this progress of this quite closely, suggested that I should simply publish the synopsis. It was quite an interesting idea, but I don't think people really want to read a synopsis.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, one of the things that is delightful about the novel and also vexing is that it has some inbuilt ambiguities, so that unlike many mysteries, it is a mystery in many levels, but it doesn't necessarily give you a pat solution that wraps up all of the, and there are many potential alternate explanations that explain who did what to who and why. So I guess I'd like to ask, you know, what would it be worth to you to share a copy of the synopsis with me? Because I think I'd get some of the answers.
I think it's long gone. But in fact, people do ask me, you know, about the sort of some of the central mysteries in the book. And my answer is always, it's all there. It's for you to decide. And in a sense, what you think happened, particularly on the wedding night, the one night on which John could have been conceived, what actually happened, that is for you to decide. Why should your opinion of what happened there be any better than mine, when both of us are just looking at the same facts, as it were, facts in inverted commas, right, which is the novel itself. But a colleague of mine who read it very early did come up with a hypothesis which I hadn't actually thought of, and which I was very at first very upset by, because it was very, very outrageous. But what I realized when I thought about it, that there was no way I could tell him that he was wrong. You know, the facts allowed that explanation as well. And that's the beauty. I mean, for me, that's the great thing about writing a novel, that you are handing something to the reader. I hate the idea, I think some novelists labor under, that you kind of, you have control of it. You know exactly what it's supposed to mean. No, I think it's much more interesting if you create something that you give to the reader, and the reader decides what they're going to do with it, what they're going to make of it.
Right.
And the book then takes on a different life and goes on being sort of recreated every time somebody reads it.
I think that is absolutely the natural life history of any significant literary work. You send it out into the world, and then it just grows and grows and grows as it takes root in the minds of the people. And I mean, and that's exceptionally obvious in the world of theatrical literature. I mean, Shakespeare, undoubtedly, every actor, every director, especially today, with the sort of the advent of what I guess they call regie theater, where you can impose, you're encouraged to impose your own views, has an idea of, you know, what Hamlet or Macbeth or Lear means that is undoubtedly would never have occurred to Shakespeare himself.
Yes. Yes. No, I also hate the kind of theatre where you can see that the director has a particular kind of axe to grind or a particular vision, and doesn't allow the viewer, the audience to pick it up and just reimagine it as they're watching it.
Yes, I mean, I think we have to be mindful of a kind of authoritarian impulse in the creators or interpreters of art. I think it was Leonard Bernstein who said, one of the glories of 20th century art is its ceaseless quest for bigger and better ambiguities. And I think that's quite right. Back to the Quincunx, you know, for those who, like me, loved their Dickens, of course, the book has many, many what I would call Dickensian resonances. I don't like to think of them as references, but you'll certainly find, you know, at a very obvious level, a resonance of Bleak House, of Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby for sure, David Copperfield, to name just a few. And when I first read the book, there were two things that immediately grabbed me about it. First of all, the complex legal structure of the ongoing chancery suit. That's rather personal to me, because I had been a law student before I decided that I couldn't think of anything I'd less rather like to be than a lawyer. And on my first day of my very first class, we had property, and I was told that one could never get a proper grasp of property without a sound grounding in medieval land law. So, you know, the idea of fefment with livery of season and, you know, other sorts of arcane concepts were drummed into my head, and to actually see that, you know, I would encounter them again, but actually enjoy it for once, was delightful. The other thing that really struck me was that this was such an unflinching and unsparing indictment of early industrial society. I kept saying to myself, this is the book that Dickens would have written if he dared to be that overt about how bad things really were out there on the streets of London.
Well, one of the sort of ideas I had in the Quincunx was that our impression of early 19th century England comes to us, of course, through Dickens and through Trollope and Thackeray and so on. And they had a strict form of sort of self-censorship imposed on them by the mores of their society. There were the things that they just couldn't tell you. They couldn't be explicit about. And yet we know if we read Mayhew, if we read social reporters of that period, we know that there were abuses that were very obvious. I mean, the number of prostitutes in London in the 1850s has been calculated at 80,000. I don't quite know how you arrived at a figure like that, but it's the truth that there was a huge amount of prostitution, and there were a lot of young women who were between being prostitutes and being servants or being shop girls and so on. There were parts of London that you didn't go into in the evening. I mean, in fact, Haymarket, the West End, there were streets there that you would never have gone into with a lady. You would have gone in for one purpose, and if you went into those streets after dark and you saw somebody, a man you knew, you would pretend you didn't know each other because you would both be there for one purpose. You were there to pick up prostitutes. And all of this was known to writers of that period, but of course they didn't explicitly write about it. I mean, there were a few exceptions. Dickens does write about prostitution, but in very kind of sentimentalized, melodramatic terms, very unrealistic terms. His prostitutes are always deeply ashamed of what they're doing and all the rest of it, and they nearly always die. And Mrs. Gaskell wrote about it much more explicitly. I mean, I suppose as a woman, perhaps she just was a bit more able to be sensible about it. So one of my ambitions was to try to write what looked like a Victorian novel with all the constraints and self-imposed censorship, but that in fact was actually breaking those rules, because it does go into the issue of prostitution fairly explicitly. And things like the section where John gets mixed up with grave robbers, or the section where he gets involved with a criminal gang, or when he's working in the sewers, all of those things, they were going on, but they're not really present in Victorian fiction. Oliver Twist and Fagin and so on, yes. But there was a large population of men called Toshers who were working underground, just picking up things that had been dropped sort of up above ground through sewers or through rainwater drainage, and were making a living by just finding things and cleaning them up and selling them. And I just found that was just a fascinating idea, that there was this kind of underground scavenging existence with, it seems, quite a strict code of conduct about how they gave each other different territories and respect each other's rights and the rest of it. In a way, a more decent, ordered and law-abiding society in the sewers of London than there was up above on the surface.
Well, that actually feeds into the idea that this is a society in which, you know, there are some safety nets in the sense that you could go to a workhouse, but you had to be one that was connected with the parish that you were registered or born in under the various poor laws, that, you know, there was a real danger of starving to death for just about anyone who happened to lose their occupation. For me, this is something that fortunately is not in the novel, but has always been kind of the symbol of the level of brutality of that period, was the story of chimney sweep boys. And and I don't know whether you're familiar with the story about chimney sweep's carcinoma, but chimney sweeping was essential because otherwise you get house fires and people would asphyxiate. But the flues were very narrow in England because they had built elaborate networks to avoid paying a tax on the number of fireplaces that you have. So you had these branching, narrow flues. So chimney sweepers would go to the families of the poor and buy their children when they were too poor to feed them. And then, and these would be children, usually boys, 3, 4, or 5 years old, and they would send them up the flues to clean them. Now, it didn't make sense to feed them very much because then they wouldn't fit up the flues. And it didn't make sense to clothe them because the clothes would get torn to pieces by the jagged edges of the creosote. And as a result, their skins were being continuously lacerated. And by the time they entered puberty, they would develop a particularly horrible form of testicular cancer, which, as it turns out, was the first form of workplace-related cancer diagnosed, and they all died horribly. And this was finally revealed around the end of the 18th century, but reforms that put an end to the practice didn't really end up being enforced until the mid-19th century. So, I mean, that's horrifying, and it actually, when I first read it, I didn't sleep for the entire night thinking about how horrendous it was. Not that John experiences that, but things get pretty bad for him. And I remember, again, when my first reading, turning the pages and saying, it can't get any worse for him. And then I turned the page and it would. He couldn't fall any lower. When he goes to the school, it's kind of like an even worse version of Do the Boys Hall. So I think that that part is really commendable. The level of historical detail, I mean, every page I found myself on my latest reading, you know, looking things up just to see, you know, was that an invention? And just to pick out one detail, since I love musical references, you know, there's this party towards the end of the book at the home of the Montpassant family. And you make reference to Collinet's quadrille band. So I went, that's on page 720, by the way. So I went and looked up and, you know, to think, oh, that just must have been a name that you picked out of the air, until I found out that Hubert Collinet was a French-born virtuoso of an instrument called the flageolet. And we find that Collinet appears to have visited England in and around 1890. He was French and spent the 1820s and 30s playing for society balls. So there, every page you pick up some interesting, and if you happen to love interesting little pieces of trivia as I do, this is just irresistible. However, to bring us to the present or almost present day, this book was written during the period when Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister. And I remember a frequent criticism, you know, as she rolled back the social safety net and began, you know, declaring war on the welfare state, that this was going to take us back to the bad old days of Victorian England, to which those who were her true believers said, how wonderful, the golden age of laissez-faire capitalism in which the nanny state wasn't telling right-thinking people what to do and eroding our freedoms. And I was thinking, well, I think that he's kind of put the end of that argument to rest, if you actually understand how horrible life was then, and also how many things that actually are prescient, like financial crises triggered by fraudulent speculations in residential real estate. That's kind of a significant piece of the novel as well. Were you actually thinking about the contemporary political landscape as well when you were writing the book?
Yeah, yes, I was. I mean, the dates, in fact, coincide almost precisely. I mean, I started writing it in, I suppose, 1978, is that right, about then, and finished it in the very late 80s. So it coincided. I wasn't grinding an axe. It wasn't that I sort of set out to, I don't know, attack the Thatcher government or something, but I was very aware, because it was in the atmosphere of the time, exactly what you've said, Brian. There was talk about rolling back the welfare state. And Mrs. Thatcher, quite early on, used this phrase that she got away with. It wasn't really picked up. She said that she wanted to give the people back the right to fail. And I thought, well, wait a minute. You know, if you really are talking about that, giving people back the right to fail, to fall to sort of the bottom of society with very few support networks, safety nets and so on, you really are talking about the Victorian period, exactly what you've said, the laissez-faire period. I mean, there was an economic theory, Malthus' idea from very early in the 19th century was that you couldn't sort of help the poor. If you helped the poor, you were actually going to destroy society, because the poor would sort of breed, there'd be more and more of them, and eventually there wouldn't be enough food and so on. This idea that really that sort of suffering and starvation are sort of are required by the economic system, that idea was creeping back in the Thatcher years. And I honestly don't think they understood the implications of it. I suspect that their knowledge of the Victorian period was actually pretty limited. And I think they simply failed to realize that the welfare state that came in after the Second World War was the absolutely basic. It was just the essential. It wasn't good enough, in fact. It wasn't a question of rolling it back. It was a question of building on it and making it work better. So this was very much in my mind, but I hope my voice in the novel never becomes shrill on that subject. I just let the facts of the 19th century speak for themselves. This is what happens if you don't actually help people when they get sick, when they're unemployed, and so on.
I don't think it does. I mean, it's very subtle and it's in the background. I'm glad that you referred to Reverend Malthus because, first of all, I think it's one of the only explicit references in all of Dickens to political theory when he has Ebenezer Scrooge talk about, you know, letting the poor die of starvation and decrease the surplus population. But you also present that sort of battle of ideas in the characters of Mr. Silverlight and Mr. Pentecost, who seem to be kind of the living embodiment of, in the case of Pentecost, the kind of a combination of Thomas Hobbes and Malthus. There's a war of all against all and everyone being purely self-interested and so on, versus the sort of a Rousseauian optimism of the Enlightenment and the belief in natural human decency and justice. Although I have to say that as the events turn about, we do see a few examples of, you know, people who are kind and generous to John. They're mostly the poor, but there's a whole lot more Hobbesianism in the interplay of the characters. Let's face it, it's a society in which, you know, when I was discussing it with my wife, I said, this is a portrayal of a society in which anyone would kill literally anyone else for a crust of bread to stay alive another day or two. And that's an exaggeration, but that is kind of a bleak social picture that you've painted.
Yes, yeah, so you're absolutely right about the sort of argument between Silverlight and Pentecost. And Pentecost is a kind of Malthusian. Silverlight, I suppose, is a kind of Shelleyan idealist, and I suppose the sort of extension of what Silverlight argues would lead you to some form of socialism or communism, perhaps. What I tried to do there was to show that the sort of relation between somebody's ideology and their real personality can be very complicated. And actually, Pentecost, who believes that giving charity to beggars is going to destroy society, is actually the most generous person perhaps in the book. I mean, he actually does give. He does kind of secretly give charity, whereas Silverlight turns out not at all to be the sort of high-minded idealist that he takes himself to be. But yes, I did try to dramatize these sort of different views of society through those characters. It is quite a dark book.
It is. Incidentally, you know, if you ever have any extra time on your hand, there are those of us who would love a book of short stories about the earlier lives of Silverlight and Pentecost.
Funny you should say that. That is really extraordinary because I am working on another project. I have been for some time in which Silverlight, I shouldn't say this, but he's going to make an appearance, but in disguise. It does go back about 30 years, 40 years earlier. So he's a very young man.
Excellent.
I'm not quite sure yet how major a character he's going to be, but of course that's going to be roughly the period of the French Revolution, and that is of course a fascinating subject. I really envy the French their revolution, an extraordinary series of events. And the weird thing is that the French don't seem to have made proper use of the French Revolution. There are actually surprisingly few French novels of real quality that are set in the French Revolutionary period. And you could even argue that the great novel of the French Revolution is A Tale of Two Cities. I wouldn't argue that to a French person, I don't think. But it is strange how the French Revolution has not really been properly exploited.
Now, the last thing I wanted to talk a little bit about is the reaction and the success of the Quincunx. Because, first of all, as you've indicated, you know, it's a daring thing for a novelist to present a book of this length and ambition as a first opus. Did you have any doubts about whether you would be able to get it published?
Considerable doubts. I mean, I was towards the end when I had this enormous book on my hands. I thought it wouldn't be published, and I was incredibly lucky. I mean, it was a sort of combination of entirely sort of fortuitous circumstances, I think, that it was published. That while I was in Glasgow, this extraordinary writer, Alistair Gray, was, I suppose, Glasgow's, Scotland's major literary figure. And I think Lanark, his masterpiece, is an absolutely extraordinary book. And it was published by a small Scottish company called Canongate. And I thought, this was about 7 or 8 years later than Lanark, I thought, well, if they were crazy enough to publish this extraordinary book, which is extremely long, maybe they'd be crazy enough to publish mine. So I sent it to them. And my goodness, they were. It was a huge risk for them, but they took it on.
Right. And it is an astonishing creation in the sense that the edition that they gave you is really a beautiful work. They included the maps that you selected just so that people could physically orient themselves in terms of the different neighborhoods of London, the creation of coats of arms, which I think they sort of gave you leave to do and helped you with find a designer. And then, of course, the various genealogical charts and very helpfully the list of characters, which runs to about a dozen pages.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people have told me that they never read books that have sort of indexes of characters, which would rule out a lot of classic Russian novels, I have to say. So I did have some doubts about that, but I didn't want, you know, I knew it was a long, complicated book, and I wanted the reader to be able to just kind of go to the back and just remind themselves of who people were and how they fitted into the story and so on. So Canongate were great for the book. I mean, they were prepared to do these things, which many publishers wouldn't have, because obviously they hugely increased the cost.
Absolutely. Now, the book is released, and to, I suspect, your astonishment and, you know, Canongate's pleasure, it became a bestseller. And to date, it's sold more than 1 million copies. It's been reprinted in how many different languages?
I think 13 or 14 by now.
Well, you know, the translation profession owes you a debt of gratitude, because you've obviously put a lot of them, you know, given them a lot of them steady employment.
Yes.
But some of the reviewers basically, I think, completely misinterpreted the book and considered it to be only an homage or a pastiche. And I think the thing that really makes this such a fascinating work is that it is a combination of, I mean, the homage element is certainly there. It's obviously there. But the use of particularly the unreliable narrators and the uncertainties about history, the fact that the one document that might have finalized the answer has three or four pages that are torn out and thrown into a fire. It's really also a book about forgive the highfalutin language, but it's a bit of an epistemological book. It's about how we understand reality and interpret history and make sense of the world we live in. And that part, I think, got missed, unfortunately, by a lot of reviewers. I'm thinking about the New York Times particularly.
Yes, that's rather how I saw it. I mean, the Victorian novel is generally, it's what I would call, it's a practice of disclosure, of sort of revelation, with a few exceptions, and James Hogg's Confessions of a Justified Sinner is certainly an exception to that. So that by the end of a Victorian novel, you are pretty much given the truth, the facts, the whole story. And what I wanted to do was to tell a story within what looked like the Victorian conventions, but actually introducing an element of, well, it was then late 20th century, sort of ambiguity and irony and scepticism. And so some of the crucial sort of issues are actually, as you say, they're left ambiguous. You can interpret them in different ways. And instead of the sort of what James called the loose, baggy monster of a Victorian novel, the sort of sprawling plot that goes in all directions, I was fascinated by the idea of giving a Victorian novel the appearance of that, but actually giving it an extremely complex mathematical structure so that everything in it is part of a pattern centered around the figure five. So that, it sounds incredibly pretentious to say it, but it's a kind of dialogue between randomness and patternedness, which is, in fact, an argument that's in the book between Silverlight and Pentecost as well. And the very image of the quincunx, there's a moment, towards the end, when my character walks across a tiled floor and he sees this pattern of quincunxes as you walk, as you would across a series of squares. But the pattern is constantly changing, and you might think you're at the center of it, but you take a step forward and you're at the center of something else. That seemed to me to be an image for what I was trying to do in the book. So I was quite happy for people to read it as a Victorian novel, and many slightly less sophisticated readers saw it as that, and I hope enjoyed the story. But a lot of readers also saw that I was doing something quite different as well. And I have to say that a book that had a huge impact on me when I was writing The Quincunx was Echo's The Name of the Rose, which I think is an extraordinarily interesting book. And I realized, I mean, again, he plays with the notion of mystery and with the detective novel and its kind of homage to Sherlock Holmes and so on. But I realized that what that really taught me was I've got to up my game, you know, that book The Name of the Rose, makes demands on the reader, and the reader loves it. You know, it is complicated and difficult. It's got long passages in Latin and all the rest of it. It goes into sort of theological issues about the nature of heresy and so on, perhaps in a little bit too much detail, but on the whole, readers absolutely lapped it up. And I just thought, well, I mustn't patronize my readers. You know, readers are intelligent people. I can actually tease them and provoke them, and I can tell them things that they might not have known before about how Victorian society worked.
Exactly. And on the subject of patterns, if people are curious, since it becomes clear as soon as someone opens up the book, the reason that there's a quincunx is that there are five families. Each family gets their own, well, actually, it's been published as five separate novels subsequently, but each of them gets their own, you know, major section. Each of those sections contains five books, and each of those five books contains five chapters. So we have fives, fives, and more fives. So it is an incredibly meticulously organized book. It seems to be that you're coming down on the side of those who believe in the argument of creation as part of intelligent design. But anyway, we'll skip the metaphysics for the moment. Now, after you wrote The Quincunx, your next novel was, I can't think of anything more different. The Sensationist which you published in 1991, is a very slender novel. It's in a completely different style. It's modern. It is minimalist. I thought of it as impressionistic. It's kind of the inner life of someone who lives in a kind of a bleak time and place and basically becomes engaged in a kind of an obsessively hedonistic life that results in something pretty catastrophic by the end. Were you trying to get the quincunx out of your system by taking such a dramatically different turn?
Yes, I was, actually. I really was. That's exactly it. I'd immersed myself in this kind of Victorian ethos with all the kind of constraints that involves, which I enjoyed. I loved, you know, that things had to make sense. They had to have complicated narrative structures and so on. And I wanted to kind of just use different parts of my imagination. And so it is exactly, it's almost the reverse of it. It's less than 30,000 words, for example. It's very short for a novel, and it's elliptical and fragmented. It's kind of sexually fairly explicit, whereas in the quincunx there's sex, but it's all terribly kind of hidden away and not talked about and so on. So yes, I wanted to use different parts of my imagination, but I also wanted to kind of signal to myself and to anyone else who was interested that I'm not going to write Victorian novels from now on. You know, I'm not going to be sort of churning these things out every 12 years or so. I want to do other things. And so, it was an extremely difficult book to write, actually. I think it was probably the most difficult. I took a long time writing it, not 12 years, but I did take quite a long time, given how short it was. And people misunderstood it. I mean, a lot of my readers thought that somehow I was describing the life I had been living myself. Far from it, far from it. It's about a young man who, in fact, plunges into drink, drugs, and sort of casual sex. Because he's obsessed, he's driven, he's fleeing something inside himself. I think and hope that he was somebody very, very unlike me. Although obviously I used a few things that I'd experienced myself, and it certainly wasn't any kind of endorsement of that lifestyle. I mean, far, God forbid.
I really, really love your third book, Betrayals, which is a kind of I hope you don't mind my calling it an oddball book in some ways, but it really is, because if someone told you that it wasn't a novel but a collection of short stories, I think you could make that case, except that it really is a novel. But it's a kind of another impenetrable mystery, and it consists of multiple stories separated by, what, 7 or 8 decades, linked by overlapping themes and events, characters and elements, the twists in the stories when they resonate forward into the future that mutate in the different versions. There's a series of murders. There's some poisonings, lots of poisonings. Scorpions play a role for those who find scorpions oddly fascinating creatures. There's some dismemberments, a good deal of Scottishness, lampoons of the contemporary academic world, which, you know, is something we've already touched on a little bit, and a really devastating send-up of cheap popular fiction with the shadow of Jack the Ripper hanging over. So my first question is, you know, this terrific, at times hilariously funny and at other times disturbing book is, did you get any fan mail from Jeffrey Archer?
More likely to have got a lawyer's letter, I think. No, certainly not. I mean, basically, that book was about sort of having fun and just taking pot shots in all directions and getting various obsessions of mine off my chest. I mean, I've mentioned my sort of unease about post-structuralism, so I had a go at that in a couple of stories. And this image, this really awful image of an African boy being sort of hung and sort of gradually severed, having his limbs gradually severed, that was my take on what I felt a lot of post-structuralists were doing to literature. You know, you take the text, you show no respect for it, you torture it, you make it say what you want it to say, eventually you kill it. Not really terribly funny. But you've described it very well. It was the challenge there was to see if I could write a book in which, in a lot of different kinds of stories, lots of different sort of styles, I mean, an obituary and a reader's report and so on, lots of the diaries, could I have the same sort of images and themes reappearing in different forms in such a way that the book actually did have a coherence, that the reader would gradually realize, yes, I can see there is a thread here. There are the same sort of issues and situations and emotions coming up, maybe centuries apart and in completely different kinds of language, all summed up in the image you've mentioned of the scorpion, this creature animated by sort of poisonous malice, which in fact stings itself to death. It's the idea of the self-destructiveness of malice and wickedness and the desire for revenge. So the book is full of people blowing themselves up on their own traps or sort of catching themselves in their own ambush.
And one of the central segments is this scandal involving a sort of a charismatic and an enigmatic cult-like figure, Galvanascus, who is the creator of a particular postmodern theory, which he calls the theory, rather portentously, and it seems to be a sort of a synthesis of literature and psychology. But the portrayal really is a kind of a cult. It has a kind of a Stalinist purge aspect to it. It also has resonances of kind of the internecine battles between the Freudians and the Jungians. The idea of introducing that cult-like element into an academic context, did you get any blowback from your former colleagues over that?
Not really. Actually, no. I think one of the things about a lot of post-structuralists, a lot of people who kind of made a career out of this strange sort of mishmash of different ideas, often conflicting ideas from different sources, usually French thinkers, who were often not terribly highly regarded in France, or they were philosophers who were not very highly regarded by fellow philosophers. One thing, they don't have much of a sense of humor, I think. I don't think you could practice that if you did have much. So I don't think they kind of got the joke or saw the joke. And they're not terribly interested in literature, as I've already said. So I'm not sure many of them would even have read it. I think the lay public, I mean, the lay reader, probably didn't really know what was going on. I think a lot of people would have not got the joke because they didn't really know what a lot of universities were being taken over by, which I think was a kind of cult, often centered around a sort of guru-like figure who would deliver very enigmatic remarks or write texts that were almost incomprehensible. And sort of the more incomprehensible they are, the more awe was generated by them. That was what I was trying to get at. And I really don't believe that was generally understood outside universities. And people who did understand it had probably got a stake in it and didn't want to kind of see the joke.
Well, it was understood by some people outside of the university. It's why I got out of the academic world and didn't pursue that as a career, because I saw too much of that around me. Anyway, just in passing, one of the really delicious features, I mean, there's another central section that is the diary of a rather peculiar serial killer. And that is quite disturbing, I found. But interestingly enough, the use of misspellings and malapropisms occurs, I think, in only two places. In that person's diary and in the work of our awful novelist named after a certain, perhaps inspired by a certain peer.
Very possibly.
Were you trying to suggest some parallels between the two?
I leave that for readers to decide. But I mean, I think what I was getting at was not so much specific people as general tendencies, I think. I was not trying to so much attack or humiliate any particular individual, but just sort of disturbing developments in our culture, I think, was what I was really getting at.
And again, for those of who are a little intimidated by, you know, having their first outing with you as the Quincunx, you know, Betrayals is about a third the length, so it's perhaps an easy way in to your inner world. Now, your other novels, which I guess you could call the Thurchester novels, because they're both set in this same town, but they're very different novels, but they are also Victorian novels. But they're separated by about 30 years. Can you tell us a little bit about Unburied and Rustication, and whether the choice of the town is a kind of an accident, or whether that's some sort of commentary from one novel to the other? How did those two come about?
It's good that you've talked about the difference in time between them, because if you think about it, the Quincunx is mostly happening in the 1820s. Rustication is set in 1860, I think 1861, and The Unburied in 1880-something. And if you think of that in terms of, say, the 20th century, how different the 1920s were from the 1960s and the 1980s. And so, you know, one shouldn't think of the Victorian period, and obviously you haven't, as a sort of single time. It's not. There were tremendous developments over that period of time. So although the novels are all set in, actually the Quincunx isn't, it's trying to be a Victorian novel but set in the earlier period, they are all very different. I mean, I'm aware of the differences between them. In The Unburied, I was trying to evoke, I suppose, the sort of claustrophobia of a small, rather decaying English cathedral town in the 1880s. And the novel is full of images of darkness and decay and of death. But I mean, God, I make my book sound so depressing. But in every case, what I'm really about,
they're not.
You take the darkest and most difficult and negative circumstances, and then you find some kind of hope in that. And so in that novel, in The Unburied, I've got this. This academic, sort of towards the end of his career, rather an unhappy private life behind him, who then finds himself in this dark world where he's forced to face things in his own past, which are sort of mirrored in the past of the town that he hears about, and then are reenacted in a murder that takes place. But in fact, he does find a kind of encouragement, a kind of hope, a kind of reason to go on. And certainly in Rustication, which is about a young man, 17, who again is plunged into the most difficult and dangerous circumstances where his very life and his sanity and his reputation are all threatened. But in fact, he survives it and he escapes. And he in the process of seeing that he has to escape physically, he escapes it sort of spiritually and psychologically. And it seems to me that that's what most of my books seem to be about. They seem to be about being trapped by circumstances, having other people's negative history and influences imposed on you, and then finding a way in which you can become aware of that, and by being aware of it, see that it need not be inevitable and that there is a way out.
In your afterword, which is published in the second edition of the Quincunx, you allude briefly to the idea that, you know, there's this quality of a kind of a allegory of the fall and then paradise regained, but it's never a perfect paradise because of the wounds, the psychic wounds that the hero has suffered. And I think that is something that you see in one way or another across your books. It's interesting also that Rustication is another young man's book. It's a, you know, Richard is a, what, he's 17 or 18 years old, you know, when he gets set down, and you know, have a hero who's battling a number of demons, one of which is addiction, which is quite fascinating. I do take your point about the vast difference between, 1820, you know, and you know, I like to think that the time frame in the Quincunx roughly corresponds to the time when young Charles Dickens went to work in the blacking factory, when he was experiencing the worst of that period. But I'm reminded of something that always stayed with me from Kenneth Clark's Civilization series, that he said one of the unrecognized greatest achievements of the 19th century in England was the evolution of kindness into a cardinal virtue, which at the start of the century it certainly was not. But thanks to people like Dickens and their preparedness to bring the poor and those who were remote socially from the middle classes to life and make us care about them, it gradually led to reform and the change of working conditions and, you know, the beginning of sanitation and many things that basically led to a kinder existence. So I think that is absolutely true. And it's one of the things that actually, that evolution of kindness is something that becomes a central tenet of a civilized society. It's one of the things that we recognize today, you know, that connects us to the Victorians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And that, as you say, that ethos, that really quite dramatic transformation in the way people thought about society was happening in about, well, I suppose in about the 1820s and 30s. That was when, I mean, these things had happened before, but I mean, that's when you got, well, you got a lot of the Factory Acts, a lot of the Protection of Children Acts. You had the ending of the slave trade a bit earlier, but then finally you had, very belatedly, the emancipation of slaves themselves in the Caribbean. And I suppose that was a huge impetus there, was the rise of evangelicalism. And that's quite an interesting subject, that you had the existing structure of the Church of England, which had dominated English society for, what, 200 years by then. But it was actually, in a way, it was holding injustices in place in many ways. There's a system of sinecures and patronage and so on. And then you have the Methodists, the evangelicals, the nonconformists generally coming along and actually going back to the sort of the basic tenets of the Christian faith, which they argued the Anglican Church had largely ignored. And when they go back to those, then they do find that, you know, they find the Sermon on the Mount, and they find the essence of it is concern and solicitude for your neighbor, for your enemy even. And so that profound transformation begins to take place about then.
Which is something that particularly today, when people who are of a more secular mindset think about evangelical Christianity, they tend to be very critical. And, you know, if they only reflect upon the enormous debt that is owed to the Wesleyans and the Quakers and various other nonconformist churches in certainly advancing the end of slavery and exposing the horrors of what was going on in the Congo, that was all connected with that movement. Well, I, of course, look forward to the appearance of any new book from you, and I was really, really excited to hear that you have a new novel on the way sometime within the next 12 months or so. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I have the title on my screen, but I don't know whether it's under embargo, whether you care to mention it.
No, I'm calling it Sufferance, which is an unusual word, but then, in fact, all my titles have unusual words. I mean, that's the sort of trademark of mine. Quincunx, Unburied, Sensationist. It's set in, well, you know, I've always hated books where you're not told the name of the town and the name of the country. You're not told the date. You're not told the names of the characters. Now I've gone and written one because I wanted to write, I mean, for all my life, I've thought the big issue that one has to write about as a 21st century writer is the Holocaust. You know, how could this horror have happened? How could it have happened in the middle of one of our most apparently civilized countries, Germany? How could it, you know, how could the land of Goethe and Beethoven have produced this horror? But I couldn't think how to do it in a way that was saying anything new and doing it with the kind of tact or delicacy or whatever the right word is when you approach a subject as difficult as that. And then finally, I did have an idea about it. And the reason why I've not got any names or any dates is because I don't want to pin it down. It's clearly happening during the Second World War in an occupied country, a country that's been invaded by a country very similar to Germany, and it's doing the things to Jews that Germany did. But I don't want to make any of that too specific, because I don't want people to start saying, well, that didn't happen exactly like that. Point is, something like that was happening across Europe, and that's what I deal with. But it seems to me that mostly this subject has been written about from the point of view of the victims, understandably, and in some cases from the point of view of the perpetrators. But the vast mass of people in these occupied countries were neither victims nor perpetrators. They were innocent people who wanted to just go about their ordinary lives, but found themselves caught up in this horror. And that was what intrigued me. You know, how would any of us have conducted ourselves if we hadn't been either a Nazi or a Jew, but we'd been in one of these countries occupied by the Nazis where Jews were being rounded up? And so what I've taken is the idea of an ordinary family living in this country who, with all the best of intentions and completely unaware of the implications, they take into their family a young girl who's 13, whose parents have been trapped by the war. And they just look after her, they think, for a couple of weeks. But they find, of course, she's Jewish. That's not said. She's a member of a minority community, which is targeted by the occupying power. And so they find all the horror of these things are now descending on them. They've kind of involved themselves in this. How are they going to, you know, are they going to disclaim all responsibility? Are they going to try to deal with it? How do they cope? And it seems to me that this is an extreme form, a very extreme form of what many well-intentioned people in occupied Europe must have felt. They knew that these things were going on. They were either not involved or they were peripherally involved, or perhaps they were deeply involved. They hadn't asked for it. They didn't know at the start. Nobody knew at the start of the war. Nobody knew what was in the mind of the Nazi leadership. And gradually that is unfolded in its full horror. So it's about, I suppose it's a book about moral choice, really, I suppose, is basically it.
And these are not simple choices. Of course, we tend to see these things in a black and white way. And obviously, your description evokes one particularly famous case of shielding a Jewish person or family that we all know about. But the fact is that when you do that, you're also putting your own children at risk. And, you know, as a parent, is it the moral thing to do? Isn't your highest duty to protect your own children, even if that involves potentially sacrificing others? It's not a black and white or cut and dried answer. And it's very easy to say for those who made the less admirable choice that they did it purely to save their own skins, or that it was a purely selfish decision, or that they were influenced by the toxic ideology surrounding them. The fact is that it has to be the case that there are as many different variants on the mixture of motivations and factors that went into those choices, either for good or ill, as there are human beings.
Mm. Yes, that's exactly it. Gosh, that's the book. I mean, that's exactly it. The narrator is the man of the family, the father and husband, who finds that he has, quite without realizing what he was doing, he's landed himself and his family in this most terrible, dangerous situation. And so at every stage, he has to make moral choices about what he's going to do and how far he's going to go, how big a risk he's going to take, and so on. And the other thing is that, having introduced this adolescent girl into his family, he finds that, of course, you take a child in, it's going to completely disrupt and change the family dynamics. What he hasn't realized is that she herself comes from a very, very abusive family background, and so she has a lot of psychological problems herself. And so he finds that not only is the family under threat from outside, but the family is now under threat from inside, from the kind of internal dynamics of their having taken into the bosom of the family this difficult child who has problems herself.
I think that's really interesting, because we tend to see the people, you know, the stereotype view is the people who have been in the position of victimhood are angelic, rather than being as richly nuanced and flawed and subject to all the inner injuries that every other human being is.
I mean, when we think about the victims of the Nazis, we somehow, they merge into one sort of heroic, tragic figure. But of course, the truth is they had all sorts of impulses and desires. And when you read about the horror of the concentration camps, one of the things you find is the way people were pitted against each other. that, you know, I might survive only if I stole your food or if I stole your identity card and so on. And it's that kind of horror of the sorts of decisions that people have to make in order to survive that I wanted to evoke and just make it terribly difficult for the reader to say, oh, I wouldn't have done that, or why on earth has he done that? To really create a kind of an impossible moral situation.
Well, Sufferance is, I understand, being published by a Canadian press.
It is. Guernica.
We're looking forward to that. Do you know what month it's going to be released? Is it scheduled?
I don't. I think they've said towards the end of this year.
Well, I look forward to it very much. I have to say, I'm also a little frightened by what is going to be in it, and I have to say that you're treading in a subject area that is likely to be challenging. So hopefully you're prepared for some pushback.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, I was intimidated by the thought of writing about the Holocaust because, you know, it is an area, obviously, in which you have to tread extraordinarily carefully. But I do think that my book, although, you know, some aspects of it are disturbing, I feel that I have created this complex moral situation, which I think has psychological and sociological truth. I don't feel I've kind of oversimplified or tried to make a point. I've tried to create as difficult a situation as I possibly can. I mean, you've hinted at the Anne Frank issue, and of course that was one of my starting points. Anne Frank was an extraordinary girl if you read her diary, but you can also tell that she was a difficult girl in some ways. The very quality of sort of intelligence and her curiosity, her desire to kind of live life to the full, were difficult for the people around her. Now, the girl in my story is not like that. She's much less gifted and able, and she has much greater psychological problems. But I was thinking how difficult the Anne Frank story would be of a girl, a family hiding, if one member of that were particularly difficult and disruptive. So I've taken some elements of that story, but I've transformed it completely. But you're right. I mean, I will certainly be criticized.
Well, I think this sort of gets at one phenomenon that I think is really an unfortunate artifact of contemporary culture. And some people call it presentism, the tendency to project our worldview, our values, our assumptions onto the minds of people in the past who couldn't possibly have shared them. And I think it's a terrible disservice to, and it also assumes a kind of a smug moral superiority, which we've kind of alluded to as well, that I find makes it very, very difficult for me to, for example, watch a lot of films that are set in different historical periods. I just saw a trailer for a film about someone that I'm fascinated by, a really wonderful, remarkable, rich character, the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, who was an Afro-French composer, swordsman, aristocrat, just a remarkable heroic figure. But in seeing the trailer, the film hasn't been released yet, it's clear that it is simply written through the lens of today in a way that will reveal very little about what he really lived through, what his achievements were, and his interactions with the society that he was part of, because the filmmakers can't imagine a world different from our own, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I mean, an awful lot of historical fiction is just costume drama. It's just fancy dress. People will prance about taking snuff and wearing wigs, but expressing completely modern sentiments. And the kind of assumptions and value systems of the society are those of our own age. And I just sort of think, what's the point? There's no point in setting it in the past if you're not going to make any attempt to understand how different the past was from our own period.
I used to think, and this is, I think, a distortion, that the world has changed so much between, let's say, 1900 and today, that you could almost regard the people of that period and our population is two completely different species. That's actually not true, because there are enormous common threads of basic humanity that carry through. But the way of viewing the world, not just, you know, that they didn't have televisions and computers and cell phones, but they really saw the world differently. Their concept of how a society should be ordered was different. The number of different rules and concepts that were simply not just inbred, but were simply part of the atmosphere. Is, you know, a friend of mine once said the very, I think, wise idea that I don't know who discovered water, but you can bet your bottom dollar that it wasn't a fish.
Yeah, that's a good line. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we've come to the end of our time, and you've been very, very generous to allow us to take this perambulation through the twists and turns of your literary creation. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope that people who have not yet had the pleasure of picking up one of your books will do so now. And I would love it if those of you who do will get in touch with me and let me know what you think and what your reactions were to Charles's work. Charles, thank you very much. We all are looking forward to Sufferance sometime in the next 12 months. And by all means, keep writing. I'm looking forward to that that project in which Mr. Silverlight makes an appearance.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. I've enjoyed this very much, and I've learned things too. I mean, you've made me think about things, including my own work, in a new way, which is very, very useful and intriguing. Thank you.
Well, that's very kind of you, and thank you again.
Right. Thank you.
Glenn Gould Foundation is a registered Canadian charity, and we rely on the support of arts lovers like you to continue bringing inspiring stories to life. Please consider giving by visiting our website, glenngould.ca. And if you're interested in keeping up with the Gould Standard podcast and more work from the foundation, be sure to follow us across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at the Glenn Gould Foundation.